to Phil Anderson, who was unable to be here. And what I'm going to try to present is a picture of high temperature superconductivity, which is not too far from what Phil would have presented. So let me begin with the phase diagram for high temperature superconductors. Okay, and so I want to say a number of things about this phase diagram. One, as you can see, the phase diagram is temperature versus X, which is doping with holes. Okay, so the idea is that in the high TC cuprates, all of the action is in a layer which consists of a square lattice of ions. It's actually copper, oxygen, copper, copper's on the corners and oxygen's in between them. But basically, you can think of it as a square lattice. There are electrons. You can think of each site as a state or an orbital which can hold a single electron. And what this diagram describes is what happens when you go from X equals 0, which corresponds to no holes, or every site occupied by an electron, to X equals, well, actually, all the action is for X less than about 0.3. OK, that's where all of the interesting physics takes place. So what happens? So what happens for X equals 0, the so-called half-filled or one electron per site case, is that you have a very robust antiferromagnet. In other words, spins on nearest neighbor sites are antiparallel. It's a long-range ordered state. And the transition temperature in that case, depending on the precise material, is fairly high, up above or comparable to room temperature. Okay. So it's AFM around X equals 0. And the point is that this antiferromagnetic long-range ordered state is rather quickly destroyed by adding holes. Then there is a region of D-wave superconductivity. Okay, it's in many ways rather conventional. Well, in some ways it's conventional, in some ways it isn't. I'll sort of describe that to you in a minute. So D-wave superconductivity. So basically, NS, which is the superfluid density, and TC go to 0 at low doping. Down here. Then there is an optimal doping. And then beyond that, TC goes down to 0 again for very, for very different reasons on this side than on this side. There is a pseudo gap region. As you go, so the antiferromagnetic state, if you like, it gives up to this pseudo gap state. Okay, so so what happens in this pseudo gap region is that a large D wave type gap grows up as you come down in temperature. So this is a picture which is very different from our picture of BCS theory. The BCS theory, if you're above TC, no gap. If you're below TC, the gap starts to develop. Okay? In these materials, as you come down in temperature, this D wave type gap grows up. But basically what that means, if you recall my picture in K space, KX, KY, let's see, how does it work? There are these nodes on the Fermi surface that we derived where, if you like, the gap grows up from zero. But the point that I didn't make, which is obvious, is that in between here, you have antinodes . The antinode is where the gap is big. Okay? So when you come into the pseudo gap region, you particularly build up gap along the 1001 directions in K space. Okay? But no superconductivity. No superfluid density. Another interesting feature of this is that the size, or the, well, right from this graph here, you can already see that the energy scale of the pseudo gap is growing as T goes to zero. And that's why the temperature at which you see this phenomena occur is at higher temperatures, and why this line slopes in that direction. Okay. So if you like, the pseudo gap is largest down here around x equals zero. And small, and then it's falling off. It's becoming less stable. Now you might say, "Oh, how do you even know there's a pseudo gap?" And then high TC is one of the most highly developed areas in science. Experimentally, there are more kinds of measurements that are taken on high TC than any place else. I mean, many fields you have one kind of measurement. You know, you build a giant detector and measure a trillion events. Here you build. You know, there are dozens of totally different types of experiments. But the classic experiment in metals physics is R versus T, resistance versus temperature. Okay, that's one of the most conventional standard. And what I would say about resistance versus temperature, not so interesting for superconductors where it's just zero, but if you're up here on this side of the phase diagram, where the thing is coming from something which is vaguely metallic, the resistance is actually decreasing linearly until it drops to zero. On the other hand, if you're down here in the pseudo gap region, first of all, your resistance is higher because there aren't as many carriers. There's not as many holes around to carry the charge. But the other thing that happens is it starts off linearly and then it starts to die, as if a gap were opening up for having these particles, or that they were getting condensed into some kind of state. So this is, if you like, one reflection of the pseudo gap. At a certain point, sort of flattens out and dies because you cross this line and it becomes superconducting. Okay? So, so So anyway, so actually let's explore that a little bit more. So what does it mean then to become superconducting? Okay? From this pseudogap phase, in the standard picture of BCS superconductivity, as I said, there's no gap, and then the gap grows up continuously from zero. And although we didn't emphasize it, it was actually implicit in Dennis's lecture yesterday that in the absence of currents, the gap has a uniform phase, and that uniform phase across the sample is part of the, that's the stable state. In this region here, one thing you can think is that there's gap opening up, but its phase is incoherent across the sample. So there's amplitude, gap amplitude arises, but the phase is not organized. It's a little bit as if you had spins of finite length, actually x, y, two-dimensional spins, that could point anywhere, and at a certain point, at a certain temperature, they all start to point in the same direction. It's exactly analogous to that. Okay? So this transition down here is where the superconducting phase is organized. In other words, where the superconductor starts to have a coherent phase, and then it can superconduct. It has some stiffness that allows it to conduct, to carry a supercurrent, to sustain a supercurrent. And then I can just jump right ahead to say, okay, what's the difference between this side of the diagram and this side of the diagram? On this side of the diagram, this big pseudogap doesn't actually turn on until you hit the line, and the transition is much more conventional BCS-like. In other words, the gap and the phase coherence appear at the same time. And then as you continue to go up in X, the whatever it is that stabilizes the gap is disappearing. So this is characterized by the linear T resistivity. Now you may say, so what, linear T resistivity, phonon resistance is linear. I mean, you can actually make a thermometer out of copper wire where you measure the resistance of a long length of wire as a function of temperature. It's very nice. It's actually quite linear over a wide region because it's totally dominated by phonons. But the point about these high TC materials is clearly, even in these high temperature regions, it's not phonons. It's some kind of weird electronic interactions that's causing. And then you don't expect linear T resistivity from a Fermi liquid. You expect, I think we even discussed this, T squared, due to some combination of electron-electron interactions and Bragg scattering off the lattice. So this is indeed a strange metal. This is clearly a strange metal. It's not a Fermi liquid. It's developing this spontaneous D-wave gap, incoherent gap. This is a strange metal. It behaves, its thermal properties are different. Once you push the doping out here, it's a less strange metal. It's an almost Fermi liquid. You can start to sensibly characterize it in the way that we've described the basic properties of a Fermi liquid. So that's the sixth point. So this is actually quite a remarkable phase diagram for a metal. There's nothing in it which looks like copper. So this phase diagram raises a number of questions. So what questions would you? One question that you can ask is how
destroyed by doping.
So usually, when you have a long-range ordered magnetic material, and you just pull out a few spins randomly, it doesn't have a huge effect. And in fact, it will have an effect which is linear in the number of spins that you pull out, and the order tends to fall apart somewhere around what's called the percolation limit, which is when you can no longer have an infinite connected cluster of spins because you've pulled too many out. Okay, this is not that. This is an antiferromagnetic phase which is extremely sensitive to holes. For some reason, if you think about it for a while, you conclude it must be some kind of quantum effect, that it's disrupted. It's quickly disrupted by putting in holes. Another question is, what's going on in this pseudo-gap region? And we'll elaborate on that later. And the third question is, how does ITC, or how does arise from the pseudo-gap phase? Those are the three big questions. In fact, this one in the middle is perhaps the most hotly contested as to what's actually going on in the pseudo-gap phase. I'm going to emphasize one picture of what's going on in the pseudo-gap phase, which Phil Anderson is largely responsible for, and then I will mention that there are competing pictures. So I think we should leave the phase diagram. And then let's just look quickly at holes in the antiferromagnet. Okay, so now you may recall, yeah, of course.
We had an expression for phi waves and z waves for conductors.
The gap? The wave vector or the dependence of the gap? Yeah, I don't think we looked at phi wave, but yeah, we do. We looked at S wave and D wave. I think maybe that's what you're thinking of. Yeah. So the S wave is a gap which is roughly uniform around the Fermi surface, and the D wave has nodes. It goes from a maximum to, it changes, it goes plus, minus in sign and changes sign at these nodes as you go around. It was cos kx minus cos ky, so along these directions it was zero. No, there is no S wave in this phase diagram, no. No, it's always D wave. Okay, and that's experimentally very, very beautifully measured. Okay, but the point that I wanted to reinforce here is we talked about why antiferromagnetism arises in a Mott insulator. A Mott insulator, just to remind you, is an insulator where electrons can't move because you can't have two on the same site, so they're stuck. If you have one electron per site, there's no place to go. We then showed that in perturbation theory, they can hop onto the same site virtually and hop off only if they're in a singlet state or anti-parallel. And that gives rise to an effective exchange interaction, J SI dot SJ. which leads to, for a pure system, long-range antiferromagnetic order, which means that the spins alternate up, down, as you go across the lattice. So what does that look like? It looks like this. Let me just draw a lattice. Okay, it looks like this. I just forget about those dots for a second. So what this means is that you can divide your lattice up into upsites and downsites. And that the quantity that corresponds to the magnetization on the up-type sites minus that of the down sites is the order parameter, and it's long-range and uniform throughout the crystal. Okay, so this is a what an antiferromagnet looks like. Now, what happens if you put a hole into an antiferromagnet? Well, it's like I said earlier, it's like removing a spin, okay? But the question you want to ask you is, because this is quantum mechanics, everything wants to move. It's the eternal struggle between kinetic and potential energy. So how does this hole move? Okay. Well, you've got your kinetic energy. So the question is, how does the hole move? And well, after it's moved, say that it's moved to here, what happened? This spin moved over, because remember, the kinetic energy can't flip spins. Kinetic energy just hops a spin from an electron from one site to the next. So this guy moved over to here, and this guy moved over to here, and the hole went over to here. Now, the thing to notice about this picture is that the alternation of the spins has been disrupted by the motion of the hole. In other words, if you look along this line here, you can see that when this guy moved here, that was a bad place to move. When this guy moved here, that was a bad place to move. So if you like, for this hole to move, it actually has to create a disruption of the antiferromagnetic order, which costs you an energy proportional to how far it's moved. So it's like tied with a string to this site. Okay? So in some sense, these... So this is a string of broken bonds. And so the hole is confined. So that's just a property of holes, the motion of holes in an ordered, long-range ordered antiferromagnet. And it is, you know, it will order long range. And so, you know, it remembers which sites are up and which sites are down. Now, an observation that Phil Anderson made is that for classical spins, or for large spins interacting via this interaction with positive J, so that they like to be anti-parallel, this type of Nail order is a stable ground state. What Phil pointed out is that for quantum spins, there's another possible ground state for the electron spins, which takes into account the fact that pairs of quantum spins like to form singlets. Okay, and the way that this works, these are called valence bond states, And so that works something like this. If you have spins S, and you put them down like this, you can say that, I mean, one way of adding up the energy of the system is by saying that each spin interacts with the one on the right and the one above it. And if you do that for every site, you cover all the bonds. Okay, you can just put those together and generate the whole lattice. Okay? So the energy, and the energy of one of these say of this bond is J, if you just, it's because they're aligned, we call the Z direction the direction in which they're aligned or anti-aligned. And then take the dot product, the transverse components average to zero, and you just get the product of the SZs. So E Nael is equal to, and this is minus because they're anti-parallel, minus, there's two bonds per site, two J S squared, where S is the projection, it's the maximum projection of onto the z-axis. It would be a half for spin half. So that's the energy per site of the Nael state. Okay, so what Phil said was this. Let's look. Let's say that we take these guys and pair them into a singlet state, and these guys and pair them into a singlet, and these guys, and these guys, and these two, and these two, and these two, and these two, until I've taken every spin in the lattice and paired it into a singlet. How well can I do in energy if I do that? Okay? Well, what you have to remember is that SI dot SJ, we've done this before, is a half times S1 plus S2 squared minus S1 squared minus S2 squared, okay, where these are vectors, quantum spin vectors. And what you mean by singlet is that this is zero. And these guys are each SS plus 1. So this is equal to S times S plus 1. OK, you guys with me? And how many valence bonds are there once you've ordered them like this? There's one valence bond for every two sites. So N over 2. So E of the valence bond state over N is equal to minus okay. And so 1/2 because of the number of valence bonds, and then J is plus 1. And so the question is, when is E valence bond less than E na L. So, well, if you work it out and say, well, this is basically what that means is that 2s squared should be less than or equal to s times s plus 1 over 2. And, well, you can cancel an s, multiply through by the 2. And that what you find is that when s is less than or equal to 1/3, then the valence bond state has lower energy. Okay, so that isn't going to happen. The smallest value that s has other than 0, which is an uninteresting case, is s equals 1/2. So, and this is for the square lattice, but you can do it for other lattices, and it doesn't get any better. Oh, I guess it gets better for 1D, but 1D you don't have a nail. Actually, 1D is valence bond states when you come right down to it. So, why would this be relevant to the destruction of antiferromagnetism? Well, on the one hand, antiferromagnetism isn't destroyed. It's extremely stable when you have one electron per site. And so right away, you can say, OK, that's fine. So, antiferromagnetism can be destroyed by holes. One of the facts is that holes in this valence bond, holes in this valence bond state can move around by having the valence bonds reform. We'll talk more about that. You can have frustration. In addition to the nearest neighbor interactions that gave rise to this, there could, for instance, be an antiferromagnetic interaction between second neighbors. If there were a term in the Hamiltonian that wanted to make these two antiparallel, that would frustrate the ordering and make it less stable. And in addition, if you think about it for a minute, you can convince yourself that it would have no effect on the valence bond state, or at least in first order. And the third thing is quantum effects. In the case of the quantum antiferromagnet, this is a very crude picture of its ground state energy. Because there are terms in the Hamiltonian that can actually flip neighboring spins. So this so-called Nail state is not an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And so if you like, there are quantum effects which lower the energy of the Nail state. They make it slightly less ordered, but nevertheless it remains ordered. And they are spin dependent. They depend on the size of the spin. Similarly, in the case of the valence bond state, there are quantum effects. This pair of valence bonds can resonate between this configuration and this configuration. And in fact, you can move, you actually have some freedom as to what you form valence bonds with. And they can, basically, there are equivalent states with valence bonds arranged differently that can resonate amongst each other. And so you can have so you can have quantum kinetic energy type effects for valence bond, and you can have them for spin waves, for the nail state. And the question is, which one does a better job of lowering the ground state energy? Okay. But I think what this phase diagram is telling you is that change, let's say, relative stability. So, but what this phase diagram is telling you is that putting holes really destabilizes the AFM state. So let's look at another thing that happens when you put in holes. So-called spin charge separation. Again, work with this little lattice. So let's look at the same valence bond configuration. But here, let's remove an electron. If you remove an electron, you create a hole. And the electron here, which was previously bonded in the valence bond to that electron, is now just an unpaired spin. Okay. Now, typically, the way we think of this is that every site was occupied, the thing would be neutral. And so if you like, the holes are positively charged because you've removed an electron, and everything else is neutral. So one way of thinking of this is this is a charge without a spin, and this is a spin without a charge. Okay, and these things are called spin-ons and hole-ons. Now, when you make them, they're together, but they can move. If this is a resonating valence bond state, then this thing can go to something like this. So what did we have here? We had this, we had this, we had this. And now let's say this hole goes up here. And let's say this spin this thing here, which is a valence bond to the right, let's say instead this guy pairs with this one, leaving a spin unpaired over here. And then what did we have in the middle here? So basically what happened is this guy went up here and this guy went over here. And now you can see that the hole and the spin are not associated with each other at all anymore. And things can recombine in such a way that they can go propagating off independently. There is no string, if you like, that tries to pull them back together. Okay, they're just free to move. And right away, you might think quantum mechanically, from the point of view of kinetic energy, that that's nice. That's the spin charge separation. So with these pictures in mind, you'd like to be able to do calculations of physical properties and ground state energies and things like that to see, you know, what really happens, or if you can model based on this RBB picture, for instance, what you see in high temperature superconductivity. Now, in order to do any calculations, you need to be able to calculate explicitly enforcing this no double occupancy rule. And the way that you do that computationally is something called Goetz-Wheeler projection. And so if you like, there's this projection operator PG, which is the Goetz-Wheeler projection operator. And it has this property that if you apply it to any wave function, many body, many electron wave function, you get a state in which there is no double occupancy. So for instance, this wave function could be the wave function of a half-filled band. On average, one electron per site, half up, half down. If you have that wave function constructed from plane waves or block waves in a lattice, you know that there's a finite probability that there'll be more than one electron. The expectation value of there being two electrons on a site is not zero, because the wave function just says that every one of them is equally likely to be anywhere. So that means there's a finite probability that two will be on a single site. You operate with the Goetz-Wheeler projection operator on that. You get out a wave function that comes from that state, which has no double occupancy, and all of a sudden it's a highly correlated many-body wave function, totally non-trivial. What Phil Anderson showed very early on is that if you take the Goetz-Wheeler projection operator and you operate on the BCS wave function, you get a resonating valence bond state. And I'm not going to try to derive that, but I will, I mean, in two lines, try to motivate it, because remember, the BCS wave function is formed by singlet pairs. Okay, it's a wave function of singlet pairs. You can do it in real space, in position space, and say you put, like we did for D-wave, in fact. That's exactly what we did. In fact, what Phil didn't show, and he laments, so you can look at the evolution of his thinking if you just go on to CONMAT and do P.W. Anderson. And some of the more, one of the more recent papers is his, you know, the story of high TC. And in that paper, he laments the fact that he didn't try, that this was an S-wave, BCS wave function. He didn't try what people did later, this has a D-wave gap. Okay, so people figured that out later based on his earlier work. So in fact, this type of wave function is a candidate for this type of phase, this pseudogap phase. And in fact, you can go on then and start from this and look at how D-wave superconductivity arises. Now, okay, so let me just say a couple of things about how easy it is to do these calculations. Basically, it's impossible to implement this. Certainly, analytically. What you can do, and what people have done, is quantum Monte Carlo calculation. So quantum Monte Carlo is a way of calculating averages with respect to quantum many-body wave functions. It's when you do that, you end up sampling huge amounts of phase space, if you like, and it basically the Monte Carlo technique allows you to calculate that average. Okay. So people have looked at quantum Monte Carlo for these things and looked for systematic behavior. And a result of these quantum Monte Carlo was to motivate something called Gutzwiller mean field theory. And so what Gutzwiller mean field theory is, in principle, is it basically tries to take all of these complicated correlation effects due to no double occupancy and build them into a simple Hamiltonian, model Hamiltonian, that you can solve using standard techniques. Okay? And basically how that works is that you can write an effective Hamiltonian for the correlated system that looks like this. So this is an effective TJ model. This is the kinetic energy. And it's scaled by a parameter. And this is the exchange interaction between spins. And it's also scaled by a parameter. And these parameters depend on the doping. And they depend on the doping in a simple, almost intuitive way. So what this says is that the kinetic energy, when the holes go away, the kinetic energy goes away. So when x goes to 0, you can't hop. And that's totally plausible and physical. This says that the effective exchange, which is what GJ is, the effective exchange coupling, is largest when there are no holes, and it goes down as you introduce holes, which, if you like, is indicated by this or by this, whichever one you want. And this theory, okay, so at this point here, you could calculate the gap function. You could calculate, use BCS theory to calculate the D-wave gap and do everything that we did as a function of temperature and so forth and so on. You could calculate this whole part of the phase diagram. You might get into trouble over here, I'm not sure. And this theory gives a reasonable description of that phase diagram. So Phil Anderson and his collaborators, he had some really brilliant collaborators, Morris Rice, Patrick Lee, Zhang. I forget whether there was someone else. But in any case, they call this theory and I think we posted the paper on the wiki for this. Now, the reason why I posted the paper is because it has all the references and the history, and except for the most recent history, if you want to look up Phil's paper on the archive from 2008. Now, just to finish, I should perhaps emphasize, and if Phil is watching, I'm sure he wouldn't be surprised that I would say this, that there's considerable controversy in the field of high temperature superconductivity, and there are competing theories. If you were to ask whether high TC is an unsolved problem, I think the fairest answer would be to say that no, it's not an unsolved problem. It's a problem which has been solved by many different people. The problem is that those solutions can be very different from each other. Okay, so the point is that there's no consensus in the field as to what the correct picture is. And whatever theory you put out, someone will point to some group of experiments that are better fit by their own theory than by the one that you offered. So it's important to say what plain vanilla RVB theory what it does not include. And what it does not include is any glue to bind the Cooper pairs together. You may recall that in the standard theory of BCS, the phonons provide the glue which binds the Cooper pair together. In the theory of high temperature superconductivity, and even more so in the theory of heavy fermion metals, things that are called spin fluctuations provide the glue which binds the Cooper pair. And I believe that it's reasonably well accepted in heavy fermion materials, which tend to be low temperature superconductors, that spin fluctuations provide the pairing mechanism. And there are people, famous people, in fact, who would say that spin fluctuations provide the pairing mechanism in high TC. There's definitely no phonons and no spin fluctuations. All there is the old Hubbard U, which is repulsive, right? Less so for singlet pairs. There are no stripes. So stripes are basically a tendency to have spatial modulations in like the electron density or in the superconducting order parameter, which would somehow mediate the interaction or stabilize the superconducting state. Okay, and in fact, it's sort of interesting because I don't know if you noticed that I drew the phase diagram this way with this little dip here, but there is actually a commensurate ordered state of electrons here, the so-called 1A state, where the holes could order, and that actually destabilizes superconductivity. But nevertheless, there are theories where there are density waves or order parameter waves, and they have well-defined wavelength orientations. They might be pneumatically ordered, and those are often used to develop theories of high-temperature superconductivity. And third, there's no quantum critical point. And there's a large school in the field which says that the behavior in the strange metal phase, where the resistivity goes like T, is all generated by a phase transition which occurs at T equals zero, but which has an effect up to very high temperatures. And so this school, which includes many really famous and excellent physicists, would say that there's a quantum critical point down here in the phase diagram, which is controlling the high temperature behavior. Okay, so basically, this is remains an intensely controversial field, and I think that with regard to Phil's contributions, I think that what everyone would agree is that he's provided these novel insights that you know really are due to him. So I mean, Phil was of course one of the pioneers of the theory of quantum magnetism back in the 50s and early 60s, and then these ideas were incorporated into his later thinking and led to the valence bond states and the RVP theory and the spin-ons and the hole-ons and all that. So there's no question that he's perhaps explained the theory of high-temperature superconductivity, but in any case, contributed those ideas. Okay, so that, I think, is the time to stop. Thank you all.